My name is Lawrence DiTullio. I am a fine art photographer doing photography in Vietnam in the past, and recently was added to the board of directors for the Global Village Foundation, an organization that I'm really very happy to be part of.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
There's a lot to talk about with the work that you do, being on the board at the Global Village Foundation, as well as the art that you have done in all your time in Vietnam. So thank you for coming on, and thank you for Lê Ly and Shane for the warm introduction.
Actually, both of those folks are really quite remarkable in their achievements, in their personal lives. So I feel like I'm in very good company.
Yeah, good humans. They're good people. Now, tell me a little bit about the Global Village Foundation.
Well, it started with Miss Lê Ly Hayslip, who's famous for the movie made about her. It was a really great movie, and it came out of her book. And her book probably can give you a better feeling for Vietnam from the war through today than most any book I've ever read about Vietnam to begin with. So she started creating a foundation, I think it was 23 years ago. It was had one name, now it has a different name. And the whole idea was that in her village, near her village, which is in Da Nang in Vietnam, which is in the center of the whole peninsula, she decided to help a lot of very poor people and poor children. So over the years, she built up a foundation to do that. And she's living in the United States because she's Viet Kieu. And she was able to have a lot of friends, and those friends helped her with lots of donations. Ultimately, they were able to build a building, and they're doing all kinds of things, especially to help children. And that's not the only foundation, obviously, doing that in Vietnam from America. But what's curious about it today is that how it's morphing to find even better ways to help. One of those things is you can help children, you know, kind of through the high school years, but they really need to end up with a career. And in today's world, you really have to get to a university. So our latest thing is to try raising money for the specific purposes of being able to help some of the children who show a lot of talent move on to the university years. And this is ideas to help pay for that.
That is a wonderful thing to raise money for, because education in Vietnam is needed, as I imagine here in the US as well. But any chance that we can get to help people who are, you know, on their way up and just brilliant kids that are coming out of Vietnam to have an opportunity is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you know, if you put yourself in somebody else's shoes, it's amazing what you can find out. So if you try to imagine yourself in the shoes of a young Vietnamese person, female and male, and they've somehow gotten this help, and they're really feeling all charged up, and they believe that their life can really come to mean a lot to them and to other people, and they get to the end of the high school, and then what? What happens then? So if you're in their shoes, that would be a terrible calamity to not be able to move forward, and you have to take a very ordinary kind of a job that doesn't pay you well, etc. But if you've been bright and you want to move ahead, that knowing that you can get this kind of help to get through the university years is quite a great thing for them. Now, I want to qualify that slightly. So from an American viewpoint, that might sound pretty extreme, because here, university education, well, we all know it's just incredibly expensive to do that today, especially in the bigger name schools. But in Vietnam, the cost of the university education is quite different than here. A good deal of that is essentially subsidized. So if you go to one of the universities, the cost structure of that is just a small part of what it might be here in America.
I have had lunch with you. We've had hours long conversation, and it was a delightful lunch. And so here we are, and I am very happy to have you here. But at the same time, I want to know why Global Village Foundation selected you, a white person, a white man, to be on the board.
It's a great question. Fortunately, I do have a reasonable answer. This all started with me being asked to go to Vietnam and spend 3 months there working with my fellow artists, who would all be young Vietnamese people who were doing avant-garde newer work, which wasn't yet popular in Vietnam as it has become today. So that was 2006. So I went there for 3 months, and then several months later, I went back there for another 2 months, and then I went back there several months after that for another month. Spent 54 months actually in Vietnam working, and with quite a bit of that in the countryside, not just in the big cities. So I guess from any reasonable viewpoint, that would make me one of the only Americans to have spent that kind of time and invest that much of myself in Vietnam, who wasn't actually going over there to live because they had married into some kind of into a Vietnamese family, which a number of American men especially have done. So that in itself is important, but also because I've been on another foundation, which has done a lot of help for women who want to build businesses in poor rural communities, and a whole number of other projects I've done. The upshot of it all is that with that much time spent in the country and that much, how should you say, emotional involvement, many of my Vietnamese friends have been surprised that I haven't moved there permanently and become part of the scene. I can't because I have four sons and grandchildren here and all that kind of thing. But you can see that with that kind of involvement, although I'm not Vietnamese, I'm well versed enough in it and driven by Vietnam and all the things that I celebrate about the country and the people and the culture.
When you were growing up, because you are, I won't give away your age because you look like a very young man on screen, but you grew up definitely during the era of the war. 50 years ago, I'd imagine you were able to be drafted or volunteered to the military. What was your perception of what was going on when you were growing up as it related to the Vietnam War?
Oh, well, it was the very beginning of it. So, I was still at a draftable age. And in fact, they did try to draft me. In terms of motivation for me, was that my parents were among the very rare Americans who had actually had contact with Vietnamese citizens when I was growing up. So it'd be the 1940s into the 1950s. And the reason for that is that my father is a well-known specialist in seashells, and he had one of the world's largest collection of seashells, and he was getting some of those seashells from folks that would probably be in the southern half of Vietnam and who lived on the coast and were fishing, and what they needed was clothing and other types of general stuff for their families. So my mother would wrap up a lot of clothing and send it to Vietnam through France. And then in turn, they would get seashells back. So some of those seashells from Vietnam are in the American Museum of Natural History in New York and in the San Diego Natural History Museum, because that's where my father's collection was divided into those two places after he passed away. So there's quite a connection there. And what you can see is that having grown up around a family who knew a little bit about Vietnam, they were constantly talking with myself and my siblings about that, the result of which that I knew something about Vietnam, and I kind of understood what had transpired there over the previous 100 years. So I was 100% against that war. I thought it was the worst choice this country, America, had ever made. And I became one of the fighters to try to stop that war from continuing.
How did your parents get in touch with these Vietnamese people in the South in the 30s and 40s?
My father was dealing with collectors in Japan. So it's probably there was a reference from Japan that way, which would have been politically less complex. But since the French were still there at the time that he got started, which is even before I was born, it's likely, too, that he might have had a connection through a French dealer as well, a French shell collection dealer.
Okay, I want, if you can allow me to go into the weeds right now, do you know anything about why your father would source seashells in Vietnam? What is the difference? I mean, you know, to a layperson like me, a seashell is a seashell, but why would he go to Vietnam to source these seashells?
Well, he didn't personally go there. My father hated to travel to begin with. So it was all done by mail, of course, back then. But the reason for that particular hookup really has to do with how people who are collectors, and especially in my father's case, he was a full-blown invertebrate zoologist trained and all that kind of thing. He became a museum curator for both of the museums I mentioned earlier. And when they do that, they're looking for the relationship between seashells worldwide in every form of ocean and fresh water, and how the evolution of those shapes, how those shells took place. And those relationships tell them a lot about how, I'm not sure I'm going to find the right word here, but what we want to know, as scientists, what people want to know is, how is the change going on within species, and how do those species interrelate with each other? Specifically in the ocean, if you've got a species growing up in the Philippines, let's say, or that's common to the Philippines, it's not long before it'll evolve, maybe in the West Coast here of America, because it can exchange the DNA through the water. We now know that that's going on through the air, because monkeys who behave, change their behavior in one place of the country, within a year, monkeys 10,000 miles away on another part of the world will have taken on the same new unusual behavior. That's a well-known concept within the biological fields. And I don't know very much about it at all. A few things I know is the information I'm giving you.
No, it's still fascinating. The amount of that, you know, that you're just giving me, it's like, it's mind blowing for me to imagine in the 30s and 40s, there's this communication that's happening between an American man and, I don't know, maybe they're not farmers, but they're fishermen, I guess. And
fishermen.
It's just mind blowing to think about in the 30s and 40s, mail going back and forth to, you know, through France perhaps, and arriving in American shores, studying these things that these fishermen in Vietnam were picking up way before anybody sort of like got there in a military way or had reason to be in Vietnam. And there's this correspondence between the scientists and fishermen. It is mind blowing for me to think about that.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Vietnam, at least in the past, was quite well known in the scientific community for butterflies that have, especially in the northern part, northern regions, mountainous regions of Vietnam. And so my father also had quite a butterfly collection that he had built up, and that was, most of that collection was entirely from Vietnam. I believe that some years ago, the Vietnamese government did the right thing, which is to stop this type of extraction of species from Vietnam to elsewhere in the world, even though scientific purposes might have been behind that extraction. Vietnam has had to do a lot to protect the wildlife, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, and I can imagine that sort of like protection, you know, even at the smallest level, seashells or butterflies, you know, it could be projected into much bigger forms of extraction. So I think, you know, starting it at the very low levels was an important thing by the government.
Yeah, I might also just add to the conversation that what generally is understood is that the atmosphere does a complete mixture of itself. It remixes itself within 24 hours. So whatever is going on here in Los Angeles, if we've ejected something into the atmosphere, some of that is getting all the way out to Vietnam and the Philippines and vice versa. In other words, it's really a very worldly process. And that's another reason why there's probably a fairly quick relationship between a form of development, even a human development, that's going on in one place in the world, and then pretty soon you'll see it happening another place in the world because of this constant mix. So everything that's in our head, everything that's coming out of our mouth, what we're saying, how we sweat, everything like that is impacted in a very minimal way 10,000 miles from Los Angeles.
And are you saying this based on a quantum kind of invisible, or are you basing it on more of a physical reaction that's happening in the atmosphere, or something more tangible? Is it something that we can't see and it's quantum, like prayer and meditation happening, or are you attributing it more to a physical property?
Okay, I'm not quantum, and I have trouble trying to figure out exactly how that works. No, I think it's something much more obvious, which is because of the winds and weather, everything, the atmosphere is churning constantly. And it's not like, well, if you have a storm here, that those molecules of oxygen in a storm here in LA don't have the ability to flow completely around the world. They do. The world's weather is constantly in a mixture. And you can see that from satellites when you see those videos from satellites. If you look at that, you see all that movement. And if you speed up that movement, you'll see, yeah, you could have something going on here that's also going on someplace else in the world within 24 hours. I think it's just purely physical thing is a way to think about it. Mixing of molecules in the air.
I always say, you know, we come here for the Vietnamese culture, but we get some science out of these kind of conversations, you know. So random, you know. Yeah. But let's go back to your first time in Vietnam. What led you to Vietnam in the first place?
Well, the simple story was that I was doing, I'm a fine art photographer. In other words, all my photography is oriented towards creating artworks. So I was doing an exhibit in a gallery, and a young man came up to me with a rather good-looking Asian woman. I remember the woman quite well. And he asked if I had any interest in Vietnam. And I said only that I'd had some grounding in it earlier in my life. And he asked me if I wanted to join a residency, is what we artists call it, where I would stay in this building that he already had created. And that was in Hanoi, and work with these 50 of these avant-garde artists. So at first, my reaction was that was impossible for me. I got together with my wife, and we talked about it, still decided it wasn't really for us. But about a month later, I was planning a book, which eventually became the book known as The Soul of Vietnam. Let me hold it up, and you can see it there for a minute. That book here, I was planning that, and with a publisher.
What year was this?
Said, no, you absolutely have to go to Vietnam. So that's why we went. That was what inspired us.
What year was that?
2006. So fall of 2006.
That was your first time in 2006?
Right. So I should add a cute thing on the end of it. When we got there, of course, we didn't know really what it would be like. Would there be language issues and things like that? What would we see? What would the place we're staying in? How nice would it be or not? Because we knew Vietnam had been, up to that point in time, or at least up to the point in which Doi Moi changed everything, had been a fairly poor country, dramatically poor in the case of the 1940s. So we didn't know what to expect. So we got there, and it turned out that there was in the building in which we are, all of these artists who we're going to get to know were already there in sort of a party format, because there was an opening of an exhibition of one of them in that very building in which we were going to be staying. So we walked in, and within the first 2 minutes, we've got a couple of Vietnamese folks coming up to us, speaking in very good English. We hit it off so great. So then an hour later, I looked at my wife and I said, do we ever really want to even go back to the United States? These people are great.
Wow.
Went on from there.
Yeah, that is something that, I don't know. I feel like, you know, we both live in LA and we live in the big city. But when we travel out to places that are, you know, I just got back from the South, South Carolina, Missouri, and driving through Kentucky and all that. You meet people that are, salt of the earth people, and you meet the same people, the same type of people in Vietnam that lived in these places are just sort of not corrupted by the crowded density of the big cities. I mean, no matter where you go in the world, the further out you go and venture out to rural areas and meet people, it's just really wholesome and good people. And I'm not saying city people are bad. I'm just saying that there is a real big difference between what we can feel with people who are giving and their generosity and their trust with the people that they meet.
I've been accused by many Vietnamese friends of being Vietnam's biggest promoter. They oftentimes think I go too far, because you know, if you're an actual Vietnamese, full-time Vietnamese in Vietnam, just lots of things that happen that you're not happy about and some things you think are great. So, of course, I think 90% of it is great. So that gets me into some trouble with my friends there. But I do feel certain things. What occurred to me and what became my book essentially was due to my perception that I had. And the perception was very simple, that at the end of World War II, the Vietnamese population was something under 40 million people, I believe. And then, of course, between the French and then the crazy Americans and then eventually the Chinese as well, and then the whole business in Cambodia, there was a lot of loss of life in Vietnam. So by the time you get through all of these war situations, you're into the beginning of the 1980s, it was really not a very healthy situation, in substantial part because of the U.S. blockading. But what the government decided to do was to encourage people to have children. And we're now, Vietnam's almost at 100 million or right at 100 million people today. And I note that Ho Chi Minh was the person who said that Vietnam, in order to keep itself whole and keep foreigners from invading them, you really needed to reach a population base of about 85 million people. It's a very interesting picture that he kind of drew for us. So putting Ming aside, if we're looking at this tremendous change that's taken place to the point at which Vietnam, unknown to most Americans, has become what I believe to be one of the more powerful and important countries of the world, it is has been the 13th and is now the 14th largest population in the world. And then you have 1.5 million Viet Q here. It's a lot. And that's just a tremendous change. And the question becomes, why that change? What happened to that? And that's one of the reasons I wanted to be there. I wanted to understand the points behind that change. What encouraged that, besides certain decisions the government made, such as Doi Moi and other things that have helped them along the line. And then this whole idea in the 1980s of how the Vietnamese people themselves were encouraged to stop feeling angry at Americans and learn to love Americans instead. And then there became a rapprochement in which that's what got President Clinton. All of these moves and then this togetherness that's been going on between Vietnam and America, all that stuff is, of course, helped. But what I really felt was the most important thing was the culture itself. I think the way Vietnamese culture works is different from China. It's different from other Southeast Asian nations. And it's a very powerful type of a culture and a very old culture. And it's that culture and the components of that culture, I think, that has caused Vietnam to grow so dramatically and now, of course, economically as well, in ways that if we were to trace back in history, it would be hard to find any situation like that that's comparable. So on that basis alone, how did it get so far so quick? And what was behind that? And I believe it's that the people themselves and the way they think and feel and a lot of what they have learned as a culture that's probably 5,000 years old.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam.
Yeah, I want to add to that. I think that the more I explore the Vietnamese culture, the more I realize the variety in the ways of being Vietnamese, because of the rich history of the diaspora, the back and forth relationship that the diaspora all over the world has with the homeland, Vietnam, it's transformed Vietnam in ways that were perhaps unforeseeable. You know, the openness that I think Vietnam has today has a lot to do with the back and forth that exists with families amongst each other, that whether it's sending money back or having so much conversation through letters in the old days, and then finally phone calls, and then finally the internet arriving. I don't know, you know, if Vietnam was ever going to stay the same if that didn't happen. And I think it was sort of a blessing for Vietnam to experience something like that.
I agree. I hadn't thought of that. I think that's a wonderful concept. And I think that's unusual. For example, my family came over here. My father was born in Italy, so I'm first generation. And I've gone back recently to his village that he grew up in, which is also coastal, much like Vietnam. And, you know, you introduce yourself and people are very nice. And, you know, in fact, I ran into people who are actually part of my family there. And yet they treat you like somehow there's nothing Italian about you because you're American. So somehow, so in other words, that closeness that you're talking about between the Vietnamese folks that are still in Vietnam and all the Vietnamese folks that are elsewhere in the world, including those that are probably even born abroad, I think that mix is not that common, that the retaining of that relationship. For example, it's Global Village Foundation. Laylee Hayslip probably got over here when she's probably 20, 21, 22 years of age, married to an American soldier. And here she is having put a great deal of emphasis on her life starting in the 1980s to trying to heal the relationship between the United States and Vietnam and to help people in the poor communities in the Da Nang area who were so badly harmed by the war. So that kind of link up, I think, is critical. And oh, by the way, in my most recent conversation with Lei Li, she told me that her biggest ambition was not just to create that sense of togetherness between the U.S. and Vietnam, but she felt the whole world needed to be like that. And she felt that she wanted to dedicate the rest of her life to that effort. And I feel very similar to that in my own feelings.
You know, I think that there is very few people of her generation that is so adamant about the closeness. There's many people who have lost a lot, lives, mm-hmm. property. Mm-hmm. They've lost their way of life in Vietnam, and they're still very bitter. That generation of Laylee's generation is still have not gotten over the hump. I've not recovered from the loss. And in order for us to become whole again, I am not sure if the older generation just needs to pass on. And, you know, this is a critical point I talk about in the podcast quite often is, you know, although we know as fundamental forgiveness is something that we all need to move on, it is quite difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would guess it would be. it's also interesting to me that some of that is maybe emphasized because the respect for the oldest generation is so important within Vietnamese culture. And that culture is common in the Viet Q community even today, even though we're talking about two generations later of people growing up and becoming adults. Let's make a contrast here. That's not the common thing in the United States. All the emphasis, commercial emphasis, and has been since 1964 when this started, that all the commercial emphasis was on very young people, because what big companies realized was that the spendable income was from people who were starting their jobs and they only had responsibility for themselves. They didn't have to own a home. They didn't have to pay for cars. They didn't have kids to pay for, all that kind of thing. So that's where it all went. And it's still there. It's there in the music. It's there in entertainment. It's there in every walk of life. So, for example, I have four sons ranging in age from mid-30s to the 50s. And I can tell you that these are all very bright guys. They're extremely capable. And I'm sure they would say that a lot of what they learned in life that's made them successful has come from myself and my wife. But they really don't have much care for the ideas and thoughts and feelings and experiences that people my age have had. They've got their own and they believe in their own. So in other words, there's no following the older generation as a way to think and feel about your current life. Whereas I think with the IQ, there's still a lot of that kind of connection.
You know, in that connection is a result of a disconnection. The yearning for the connection, and I'm speaking from firsthand experience, that connection comes from this deep disconnection, this deep cut ties with our culture, with our motherland, this severance of the umbilical cord, if you will, with my generation and what is really happening in Vietnam. And the reality is, I have a yearning and a thirst to be entirely Vietnamese, but I'm entirely American. So I have this dual sort of identity that exists 100% as an American and 100% somebody who understands the Vietnamese culture from the inside. But at the same time, I don't feel like I'm one or the other as well. So that that weird sensation of not being accepted in the American culture, not being accepted entirely when I go back to Vietnam, but understanding the American culture from the inside, understanding the Vietnamese culture from the inside, creates this weird bridge and bond that I will probably never lose to the day I die. And I think that's sort of the difference between even your sons and you and kids who are growing up in Vietnam right now, who didn't experience this this cut that this diaspora has experienced. So we are a unique bunch of people that were separated from our mother, basically. And your sons and you are experiencing a relationship that's healthy, that's intact in terms of cultural sort of integration. And I think that the kids that are born in Vietnam after the war and their parents, they also feel the same way. They don't have that need to question what does it mean to be Vietnamese as the kids in the diaspora, myself, being born in one of the first kids to be born in that wave right after the war. I just have this sensation of being lost. I've always felt that way. Even when I go back to Vietnam, I don't feel whole and I don't feel whole here. But at the same time, I feel entirely Vietnamese when I'm in Vietnam and entirely American when I exist amongst my white community here. It's the strangest feeling.
I think seems to me that there's two pieces to that. Let's just go back to my sons for a moment. As I said, they have phenomenal lives. Their successes, which are their own, they're really not due to me. It's entirely those guys and what they've been able to make out of their lives, which is beyond phenomenal. But there's another thing going on here. This fact that they don't really, at this point in their lives, would not necessarily refer to me or to my wife for information, for suggestions, things like that. Or if they do, it'd be very rare. And the reason for that is that the dynamics of life have changed greatly within a couple of generations. Let's just start with something as simple as the internet. So, the internet didn't really become the internet the way we understand it until around 1991. And that made a rather dramatic, began to make what's become an obviously very dramatic change, both technically speaking, but also how the world operates, how people integrate with each other or don't integrate with each other. All of that kind of thing. So I don't have to elaborate on that because I'm sure you and the audience knows what I mean. So with all of that, the older generation doesn't typically keep up with that kind of an evolution. So in a way, they're a little bit out of it. And because of that, doesn't make sense for younger people like you to reference their parents that much for information, intelligence, background, older experiences, because they're really not germane to today. So it makes perfect sense for this generation, your generation, and then the generations coming up and back of you, the ones who are probably 20 years old now, it makes perfect sense for to have to rely more on yourselves rather than the preceding generation. So that's item number one. The second thing is, I think we need to make a comparison here. What you're saying about your feelings towards Vietnam, I think, is very critical, because, again, it speaks to culture. And that culture, the best word I can think for it, is the tremendous amount of collaboration that's involved. I think Vietnam is, of all the countries I've been in, it's the most collaborative society, the society in which people link up with each other and share with each other and relate to each other, to the point that if you're in the middle of one of the big cities and you're at a major intersection, you've got the 3,000 motorbikes there and 3,000 there and three there and three there, somehow or another, there's a collaboration, an unseen or unsaid collaboration between them, that they manage to make that all flow beautifully. Now, I've been on a motorbike all the years I've been in Vietnam, and I can tell you that flow is kind of has its own kind of an energy and a feeling to it that's pretty marvelous. People will pull up in a big city like that with all these motorbikes, and suddenly there's all these conversations going on while the traffic light is red. I don't know that you can see that too many other countries. So there's something in that collaboration that's fairly unique and fairly profound in Vietnam. And as a consequence, I think you're feeling that, and that it's essentially a loss of collaboration is what you're talking about. You're here, they're over there. Some of your family is there, some of it is here. The collaboration is much more difficult. Fortunately, you've got what we're doing right now. We've got Zoom and these other means. So maybe that problem for younger VIQ people will go away ultimately because of this communication possibility.
I love speaking to artists because of this, ability to analyze these sort of idiosyncrasies in life. And, you know, even though you're a fine artist, you're able to articulate in words these differences, and they may or may not be accurate. They may or not be perfect. They may or not be true to the senses of somebody else. But what I love and respect is that there is an ability to kind of like think about it and simmer over this idea of collaboration. And it's a beautiful thing. This is your opinion and your observation. And I value it because it is something that I've never thought about. And I hope that the audience can sort of see that this is a very valid way of looking at our Vietnamese society from the outside, looking in. Mm-hmm. And with that, I want to lead into the way that you perceive the country as an outsider, and how do you know what images to keep, what images to take, what images to shoot? How do you kind of like the process of feeling all of these emotions that you want to present visually? What is your process? I know this is a very clumsy question, but I think leading in from like how you've just kind of explain collaboration, it's interesting to hear your outsider's perspective on how you see the world of Vietnam through your lens.
I think there's a couple of good words that would help to describe that. One is that I'm very impressed by the feeling of energy that's before the camera. So if I'm walking along and I discover a person in the street, I think it's interesting for some reason, I start a conversation, we kind of hit it off. One of the attractions probably has been that there's an energy there coming out of that person, something you just feel, to the point that you decide that making a photograph of this person would make sense, especially if it's going to show up in a book or exhibit or something like that. Because you want other people, and you want, in my case, especially you want Americans to understand the energy of a Vietnamese person, such as yourself. I want them to know that. So the energy component is certainly one of those things. Another thing that artists, especially photography artists, use a lot is time. So when you're looking at something, there's always a feeling of time involved there. Either time is slowed down or speeded up. So you are reacting to that. Usually intuitively, it's not something you're analyzing in your mind. You don't even have the time to do that in most situations, because the situation is very fluid. You're trying to capture that 1/100th of a second in which that both that fluidity and the sense of time behind that has become exactly the point at which you want. So if you get really good at this over a lot of years, and typically the type of people are very good at it are those who are doing an editorial type of a work, which is what my book is. Essentially, it's editorial photography. It's opinionated. It's not meant to be accurate or anything else like that. It's just my perception of things, which is why I'm called a fine artist instead of a news journalist. Because I'm not trying to be objective. I just want people to know how I feel, what I've experienced with all of this. So anyway, those are two components. Now, there's a lot that goes into there, and we can't cover that because I've been teaching photography for a lifetime. And I could tell you that it's a lot of work. It's 4 years of steady work to get somebody up to speed and all these things that go into this perceptual question that you've asked.
How do you know when to keep an image to go to publish it in a book?
That's a great question an answer that's important, I think. Most photographers, especially if they're fine art photographers, working from within themselves rather than working for another party like an editor of a newspaper, they're going to take a lot of them. Because they don't really know after they've made them and compare them and sort them all out later on, which ones are going to feel more appropriate to the situation. Is it a book? Is it an exhibit? Is it going to be online? Those kinds of questions. Which ones of the images are going to be appropriate to the major point of the book? So in my case, it's probably in my inventory now, probably 400,000 images, because I don't throw them away right away. You can store them online. Why should you? So they just sit there. That had to be boiled down to about 1,000 potential images for the book, knowing that the book would have 150 images in it. And that brought it down to 450 images. Now, if I've got a great little story that you've got to hear here. So at the point at which I'm at that point in the book where I'm now boiling down to 450, so I know they're all strong. I know they're all relevant to the points that I want to make in the book. I know the book, I need to kind of get it done. So I don't want to waste too much time. So I decide to take the 450 photographs. I took them to a local film processing place and had them just make little postcard size images for me, prints for me. And I put them all down on the ground of the apartment I was staying in. Now, the apartment happened to be owned by the family of a young woman, Vietnamese woman, that I had hired to be my assistant to really help manage my work there. And she was a very, very good manager. So I trusted her, although she knew not anything about art. She came from kind of family where they would have never had a chance to interact with that. She certainly didn't know anything about making a book. But she had been a very loyal helper and a great friend for about a year. So I asked her to come up to the apartment and take a look at all these photographs. I said, tell me, I know which ones I've made notes on, which ones I think should be in the book, but I want to know what you feel. I'm going to stand up here so you can see my little demonstration. So she's walking around looking. And finally she said, I said, well, what do you think? She said, no, 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 yes, yes, no, 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 yes, yes, yes. And she went through all 45 of them in about 10 minutes. She said, all the ones I said yes to, those ought to be in the book, and the rest of these, no. Now, how would she know? But I thought, you know, it's her culture. She knows. And I'm very glad she did that, because those are the images that are in the book, and I think it made the book all that much better. So thank goodness for her tremendous help and her great intuition and insight. Another example of how I read Vietnamese people in general. I think she and the gods collaborated to make sure that I didn't screw this book up. And I am pretty happy about how this book has been. And it's almost sold out. I think we maybe have 50 copies left here in the U.S. Half of the 1,000 that were produced were sold in Vietnam and the others here. And the reason for that was an essay by Nguyen Quy Duc, who's a very famous Viet Kieu guy who's been back in Vietnam as long as I have been there. And he wrote this essay, and it didn't seem appropriate for the Vietnamese market, but it did for the American market. So he did two separate printings, 501, 500 the other. So the one here, the ones that I have here include Mr. Duke's essay. People, if people from your blog are reading this, they might recognize him as a very famous news guy on television in the United States, being broadcast out of San Francisco. He became quite well known.
Winkweeduk, if you are listening, I've reached out. I would love to have you on the podcast. He's an important figure in the literary world, in the intellectual circles. He's quite an interesting man. But I want to go back to the woman that was picking out these photos with you. What do you think that she was seeing? Why do you think that she picked the ones that she did? Is there any way that you can systematically articulate what you think that she was seeing?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I should point out that I've been photographing for already 45 years when Hua, that's her name, when she came along and kind of became such a close friend. And the answer is, I think, pretty simple. In all of those years of teaching and being a photographer and doing exhibits and getting all kinds of help, financial help for my career, all that kind of stuff going on for so long, there were some things I still had to learn. And frankly, despite my age, I'm still having to learn and sometimes learning from younger people. And that was that the image, the point of the image, the intention of the image has to be very clear. If it takes people a little bit of work to try to figure out, okay, why am I looking at this image? What importance does it have to me? What reaction am I supposed to have out of it? That hurts the relationship between the image and the person viewing it. So intention becomes a driving force for a photographer. The interesting part is that if I'd been a journalist photographer doing this type of editorial work, I probably would have known that far earlier, because in journalism, you're told what point, you know, you're sent out there to do, get these photographs of a situation, and the editor has a specific point in mind. So you're always working from that point. You're not working internally from just your own feelings. So it's not surprising to me that I didn't know that, having never been a journalist. But it was good to find that out. And I think my work has been better for it. And I owe her a lot. And she knows that I owe her a lot.
So, if your book is for sale publicly, how would people find it?
They can go to my website and get it directly from me, which is cheaper. And
what is
I also sign it for them, which is kind of nice. And that's www.larry, my short name, larry.tilio.com, which are you able to flash that up on your screen?
Yeah, I'll put that in the link. Yeah. So if anybody wants
to. There's not many left. And I really think that I'm going to at least do two more books in Vietnam. But I don't know that they'll be like this. I'm very interested in rural women's situation in Vietnam, and I've worked a lot with rural women there. So that kind of finding out more about that turns me on. So that's likely to be the next book. It's about women, and more specifically rural women. I hope that's how it worked out. So this may be the last few of these that are around. So if people want them, they should get in touch. If you go onto the website and then you go to the pull down menu book, you'll see it's available for sale right there. And then I will ask the person if they would like it signed and what they would like, besides my signature, what comment they'd like me to make. That's pretty typical for almost everybody who's bought it directly from me. You can get it at Amazon, but you need to put my full name in along with the title of the book, The Soul of Vietnam, but you won't find it otherwise. It's just the way Amazon works. Crazy.
Now, I want to end on this Global Village Gala that you're having coming up here at the end of the year. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I'm losing your voice, Kenneth.
I'm sorry. Can you tell me a little bit about the Global Village Gala that's coming up at the end of the year?
Right. So that's on November 18th. And we're just in the middle of sending out cards to say save the date. So what that's going to be is, since it's the evening is a full blown gala with food and tables and all that kind of thing. It's an actual sit down thing. Kitaro, the famous musician, who provided the music, who composed the music for Heaven and Earth movie. He will be there with his group playing, and he is to be honored at that. Ted Ophius, a former ambassador of Vietnam, who is a friend of mine. We know each other. He is going to be there and also be celebrated. And certainly some of the other folks who are well known in relationship to the movie and to Lely's book will also be there. I don't know all of them at this point because some of them we're asking and we haven't heard back from them yet. But anyway, it's that kind of a deal. So there's a whole big thing after the dinner. There's a whole presentation that's going on with music and all kinds of other great stuff. And then prior to that, to the gala itself, in the afternoon, probably in Orange County someplace, there'll be a what amounts to the 30th anniversary screening of the movie, which everybody can go to. It will be in a theater someplace. And a little bit of discussion by some of the people involved in making the movie, including Miss Hayslip, Lely Hayslip, who the movie is about. We'll be giving a little talk before or after that. And in the morning, Ted Ophius, the ambassador, who's come out with his own new book, and Lely, of course, who has her two very famous books out, they're going to give a whole presentation about books and how they thought about them and how these books came to pass in the morning session. So there's actually three things you can attend, or you can just go to the gala and enjoy all the stuff going on there. There'll be, I think, an auction thing going on. I'm actually going to have a photo booth there. So I'm going to photograph everybody who wants to be photographed with a portrait kind of thing. So it's going to be very exciting. But the whole idea is to celebrate not only people, including Kim Phuc, who you will probably all know that name, but for regular Americans, I have to always say, oh yeah, she's famous as the
Napalm Girl,
right? It's an unfortunate thing, and I'm hoping that Nick Oot, who I know, who did the photograph, I'm hoping that he will be there as well. And it's just going to be a phenomenal thing. Whether you're American like me, it's a phenomenal thing to be part of this whole day. It will be terrific for anybody who's at Q.
Thank you so much, Lawrence, for coming on. And I will, include some of the links to the information that you just talked about. And I really appreciate your point of view today and spending time with me. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate your interest and the chance to express my fervor for Vietnam and for Vietnamese people.
Thanks again, Lawrence.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.